I'm going to be taping this. The microphone only picks me up. It won't pick you up. I'll have this available as an MP3 file. So if any of you want a copy of this, you can just give me your business cards, and I'll give you the link for the MP3. Grumpy. How many of you remember Grumpy from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs? You know, constantly had this frown on his face, and just a kind of a nasty guy. I'm not really, when I talk about, I want to define grumpy a little bit, and in terms of what I mean. You're all familiar with the basic accounting equation. You probably live with this day to day. The basic accounting equation says assets equals liabilities plus owner's equity. Now, that's more than an accounting equation. It's also a statement about value and psychology. There are two ways you generate wealth for your enterprises. The first is you increase the assets or the revenue. I'm sure that gentleman from marketing, that's the side of life that he lives on. People who live on that side, the asset enhancement side of life, tend to look at the coffee cup as half full. And for them, life is full of opportunities. They're attracted by innovation. They really gravitate towards risk. And their attitude is, why not? Then there are people on the liability side of life. And their attitude is, the way we generate value for our company is to reduce risks and reduce liabilities. I'm sure in your work, in training of environmental health, it's all about risk management and risk reduction. It's not about asset enhancement. In your work, I'm sure it's the same too. People who live on that side of the accounting equation are not necessarily grumpy like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but they live in a world where change involves risk. And risk is to be managed. And risk is a threat. And their greatest value is to reduce risk, reduce costs, reduce uncertainty. And that's the side of where that's how they make a contribution. And so they're on the liability side of things. So when I'm talking about grumpies, I'm really not necessarily talking about bad or negative people. I'm talking about people whose perspective about life is about risk management, reduction of risk, mitigation of risk, and change is always a threat. So that's what I mean by grumpies. I'm writing an article right now for MIT Sloan Management Review on this topic, and if anybody, it's a work in progress, and if anybody would like to a copy of the piece, I'll be glad to send it to you. Just give me your business card and write the word MIT on it. And I would appreciate your thoughts and comments. It is a work in progress. I'm going to talk about three things. Grumpy cultures, grumpy organization structures, and then finally grumpy people. First, grumpy cultures. I'm sure if I sent out that survey, most of you kind of said, oh yeah, it's very important. Customers are positive and they're 10. Does that necessarily mean that you have to have a positive, upbeat corporate culture? Not necessarily. There are some cultures that are really set up to be grumpy type cultures. And they have to be grumpy type cultures. For example, one of my clients is an insurance company. It is not true that all functions are created equal and all functions are important in the eyes of God. No. In a well-managed company, everybody knows one function is more important than any other function. And in my client company, that function is the underwriting function. CEO came from underwriting. The most powerful, the next person who will be CEO also came from underwriting. Underwriting dominates this company, and underwriting is all about the reduction of risk. I have another client company that is a utility company. Customers they're not in the business of customer delight. Because, you know what, customers don't react positively when they flip the switch and the light goes on. They're not delighted. What they do is they go through the roof when they flip the switch on and the light doesn't go on. They go through the roof when the heat goes off. So there's an imbalance. When things go wrong, they go really wrong. And when things go right, you don't get any credit for it. And so in that company, again, there's an imbalance on the risk mitigation side of things. So having a grump, what I would call a grumpy kind of culture, is not necessarily a bad thing. And there's certain organizations where it has to be that way. Any of you operate in a company that's biased on the grumpy side? All right. There are also cultures where there's a bias on the non-grumpy side, and we'll be talking about that later. One of my first clients was a man named Arthur F. F. Snyder. And Art Snyder was the CEO and chairman of the board of a company called Colonial Bank and Trust, which was at One Post Office Square in Boston. And then later on it was acquired by U.S. Trust, and Arthur became vice chairman of the board of U.S. Trust. And then U.S. Trust was acquired by Citizens, and now Arthur's retired. His claim to fame was that in the 1970s, there was a new technology company called Prime Computer, and it was looking to get a loan. And no banker would give it a loan because it looked risky. And Arthur gave them the loan. And he was the only banker who took a chance. And then Prime Computer had a spectacular run. I think it was acquired by Computer Vision later on. I asked him, what did you see in Prime Computer that no other banker saw? And he wrote down the basic accounting equation, assets equals liabilities plus owner's equity. He said, what I saw at Prime Computer was, I saw a very strong person managing the asset enhancement side. In other words, very strong vice president of sales and marketing. I saw a very strong person managing the liabilities side of things. In other words, a very strong chief financial officer. And I saw a CEO who saw his role as to be the mediator between two clashing views of the world and basically be the final arbitrator. And I said, that's a sign of a really healthy organization. And I always remember him saying that because as over the years, I've seen so few companies that are structured like that. Most of the companies that I see are structured around the big lie. And the big lie is we're one big happy family. And I'm the CEO, I'm the daddy, I'm the mommy, and we're all in this together. And after all, we're here for shareholder value. And we're here to make our customers happy. And so we're all together. That's nonsense. No organization functions that way unless you've got a very small business. The founders of the Constitution looked at things just the way Arthur F.F. Snyder did, and that is, life is a series of conflicts. It's about checks and balances. As a matter of fact, conflict is healthy. If you were looking to get the best apple pie recipe in the world, how would you do it? Would you go into the library and try to look at apple pie? Would you go and hire an expert to talk about apple pie? Or would you get two of the best apple pie cooks that you know and ask them to debate each other? Because often in the process of debate, that's where things come. The legal system is an adversarial system. Despite what everybody says, it works more than it doesn't work. And so what Arthur Snyder was talking about is structuring organizations to promote conflict. Structuring organizations so you get a very strong person on the marketing end, you get a very strong person on the CFO side, and the CEO says, my role is to mediate between two strong people. What I do see is the following. We're all one big happy family, and all functions are important to us. And the CEO is aligned on the asset side or the liability side. So in the case of Lehman Brothers, Richard Fuld, who was the president of Lehman Brothers, was a very aggressive, growth-minded guy, very asset-oriented. So he was not only the CEO, he was the chief asset enhancement officer. And he hired a very strong vice president of marketing to be his ally. And he had a relatively weaker CFO. And he had a relatively weaker general counsel. And he had a relatively weaker vice president of risk management. And so he structured things so that there was an imbalance of conflict between the areas. And that proved to be disastrous for Lehman Brothers and the rest of the economy. So again, in terms of designing structures for grumpiness, I think the best way to structure organizations is to look at conflict, get rid of the one big happy family idea, be careful about hiring people because you feel comfortable with them. Sometimes it's not about feeling comfortable, it's about being effective. Sometimes you really want to hire people that you're uncomfortable with. Again, the best ideas come out of clash, not necessarily out of harmony. The problem with we're all big one happy family is it tends to promote groupthink, and that can be disastrous. One of the roles for leaders is about language. How does change come? How do people change? Sometimes some people say, okay, first you have to change your heart, your emotions. You have to really feel it. And then if you do, then it'll move to your brain. And then once your brain gets it, then you'll actually behave that way. So it goes from in to out. But there's another way of looking at it equally, and that is first you change the behavior, then the brain changes because your behavior's changed. Once your brain changes, your heart will change. Now that's an old concept. For those of you who ever read or saw Hamlet by Shakespeare, there's a scene in Hamlet, a very dramatic scene where Hamlet confronts his mother and she collapses and cries and she says, "Oh my God, I'm such a dirty whore. I colluded with a man who murdered my husband. Then I married this man. How can I ever be pure again?" And Hamlet says, "Well, you're not. But tomorrow, why don't you act as though you are? And then the next day, why don't you act as though you are? And if you continue to act as though you're something you actually are not, maybe you'll become that which you're acting." And that's what they did. Does change come from the inside out or from the outside in? You know what? It's both. Because it's a complicated social system. So one of the things that I have seen with organizations is the need to be for the leader to focus on language and shape language and have employees say certain words in certain orders. I'll give you some specifics. One of the, in America, I think some of the great quote unquote happy customer cultures would be Disney, Nordstrom's, Apple, Southwest Airlines, JetBlue. Can anybody think of any other companies in the United States that really are profoundly good at producing happy customers? Anybody know another one?
American Girl Company.
American Gorilla?
American Girl.
Girl, okay.
Doll.
Anybody else?
Happy to buy a $1 doll, yeah.
Okay. Any other companies?
Okay.
All right. Let's look at Disney. The extrinsic product, in other words, is the physical experience that you're paying money for would be movies that you're watching, theme parks that you take your family to, games, video games, ice shows, musical shows, dolls, retail stores, television channels, hotels, restaurants, and CDs. There's probably more. But there's a lot of stuff. Actually, Disney's only selling one thing. The intrinsic product that everybody buys when they pay money for Disney is we're going to have a happy time as a family. And we're not going to have a happy life. We're going to have a happy few hours. Maybe a happy day. But Disney is not in the business of ensuring a good life. Just a few good, happy hours as a family. Now, in order to do that, how many of you have ever been to a Disney theme park? Okay, so just about everybody. If you ever looked at a Disney park from an operations point of view, it is very tightly managed. When you're dealing with that many people, with that many children, and that many rides, nothing is given to chance. Everything is organized. There's no spontaneity at all. It's tight. Very tight. And one of the things that Disney does is they control the language. And they're very fierce. If you obey the language, you get to keep your job. If you disobey the language, you're fired. So there's a reward and penalty. The first language is, what do we call the people who pay for the services? They are not customers, they're guests. What do you call people who work at Disney? They are not employees, they're cast members. And the motif is, this is a show, and everybody is an actor or an actress in the show. And some people have big parts, and some people have small parts, but it's all show business. So put your ego, leave it at home. You have a role. Play your role. Scripts are given to cast members. You must read the script. You must not deviate from the script. If you deviate from the script, you are fired. Let me give you two examples. One thing that is given is there are cast members who wear costumes. Mickey, Minnie, Goofy, you've seen them, right? Other cast members know the names of the people who are actually wearing these costumes. They are never permitted to utter the names of the cast members. Everybody is going to be referred by their Disney name once they are in costume. And it is amazing because I have eavesdropped on conversations of technicians, lighting technicians, as they're setting up a show. And they don't know I'm listening to them, and they stay in character. They will always refer to all of the characters by their Disney names, never by who they really are, even though I know they know who these people are. Second thing that is Disney is you can never say no to a guest. The word N-O can never be uttered by an employee. For example, the Disney operations is a park. It's a public park. How many of you have ever seen signs say, do not feed the pigeons in a park? That's a public health. You know, it's not the company that says don't feed the pigeons. It is the public, usually the public health board that says we don't want you to feed the pigeons because pigeons carry germs and, you know, just don't do it. So Disney is supposed to have signs that says do not feed the pigeons. They refuse to do it because that says you no to the customer. So you'll never see a sign that says do not feed the pigeons. So one day I'm at the dining area and there's a couple and they're having hamburgers and french fries and there's pigeons all by their feet. And they think it's cute. They're taking off things from the bun and they're throwing it down for the pigeons. And there's a guy next to them who cleans up the restaurant and he cannot say you can't do something. He can't say no. So what he does is he goes over to them and he has a whisk broom and a thing and he just cleans off the bread that they just dropped, and he just smiles at them. And they don't get it. And so they drop more bread for the pigeons. He just smiles and cleans up the bread. And finally, it dawns on them. But again, he operated in character. You never say no to a guest. Why is this important? Because part of what management is all about is shaping the words. What are you going to say to customers? What are you going to say to colleagues? What words are prohibited? What words are verboten? For example, in some of the companies that I work with that have grumpy people, we have a rule that says you can never criticize somebody for what they've done without first telling them what you liked about what they did. And if you can't tell anybody what you liked about what their idea is, shut up. It either means they're insane, or more likely, you don't understand. You know, don't criticize until you can have a balanced point of view. We actually have a whole structure about how do you give feedback. So instead of saying, you know, I think you're you lack enthusiasm, I think you lack commitment, I think you're poor detail, we say, here's what I like about what you're doing, here's what I don't like about what you're doing. On balance, here's where I'm coming from. It's a scripted way of saying things, just like the Disney organization. So again, let's go back to the exercise that you just did. Would you change your number based on what I just said, or would you keep it? Again, this is something you don't have to discuss with others, but do you really need that happy a culture or not? I'm going to give you another exercise to do. And this is actually not the same. Yep, please. Oh, by the way, please, at any time, ask questions, make comments, anything.
Yes, that's what attracts and retains top of the customer, the positive customer experience is critical. It doesn't say happy. I look at positive as being something that whatever the client is looking for, they would get. And what do they come to you for? That's what the positiveness that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So happy. So
okay.
I answer it in a different way.
All right. You're right. This is a slightly different question. The first question really is, what do you think? This next questionnaire is really what would your best customers, your most profitable customers say? Everybody got a... Okay. Oh my. What I'm about to say comes from Fred Reichel's book, The Most Important Question. Fred was a consultant with Bain & Company, which is a large strategy company. And Bain does a lot of surveys of customer satisfaction. And one of the things that they found, like a lot of people who take polls, is that there's very little correlation between what people say on customer satisfaction versus what they actually do. And so he's trying to find what questions actually correlate best with actual customer behavior. And he found that the question that seems to correlate best with actual customer behavior is this one question that he had. If I would recommend this company to a friend or colleague, 0 never, 10 always. And what he found was that people who scored 8s, 9s, or 10s were customers that were very likely saying positive things about the company to their friends and colleagues. These were the people that are most likely going to be most receptive to new product augmentations that your company is trying to do. You do walk dogs? Or
take them into a day.
You take them in? Okay, so let's say in addition to dogs, we'll take in elderly women and men, right? People who score 9 out of 10 might say, you know, he does such a great job with my dogs, why not my mother?
Actually, better off. Child being here next door.
So. Yeah,
but then the dogs will wake up the kids.
On the other hand, if somebody scores 0, 1, and 2, they are actively negative. They are actively saying negative things about your organization. They are going to be totally opposed to any product augmentation because they don't think you're doing what you do, your core business, well. You have a problem with these people. Years ago, General Electric looked at customer satisfaction and the feedback mechanisms that went on, and they came to a conclusion that everybody knows, which is if you have a happy customer, they're going to tell about 1.5 people that they're happy. If you have a dissatisfied customer, they're going to tell 7 people. Now, that was about 15 years ago. Now, with the rise of Facebook and LinkedIn, I think about 700. You know, I have a BlackBerry. I've got one of these Black. I downloaded something off BlackBerry. It was an application. Paid $10 for it, and the thing just didn't work. I was so frustrated. So I went on Facebook, and I said, you know, don't get this. It's garbage. So I told everybody in my group. So today, when you have a negative customer, it has far more implications because of social networking. This is one of the things that when people are terminating employees, again, the grumpy culture is you bring in a CFO, a general counsel, and an HR person in a room, and they talk about reducing legal liability, reducing costs, and making it easy to manage. So they're all focusing on the liability management side of things. However, if as a result of all that, the employees that you fire feel that they were treated like garbage and they were treated with disrespect, they're leaving grumpy, and they're going to tell their friends. And one of the things that I'm trying to do with my clients is if you're going to be laying people off, make sure there's somebody who is on the asset enhancement side of the balance sheet to counterbalance the liabilities disbalance. Because often the way you terminate employees, you can terminate employees so that employees feel they're part of the company's alumni. And so you still have got them hooked in for the future. The way, let me give you an example of how this can be used to look at cultures. Are your customers grumpy? And is there something you need to do about it? For example, one of my clients is a high-tech company. They produce a robot that goes underwater. These robots can be the size as small as this. It can be as large as this table. Applications in the oil and gas exploration business, these robots can go way underground, more than a submarine can, and using sonar can map local terrain. For the Central Intelligence Agency, you can get something as small as this and can navigate up a river and then go alongside a boat and then blow the boat up by remote control. So they have only 17 customers around the world, but these customers tend to be military, the security, the intelligence community, and the oil and gas and exploration. And they all talk with each other. And so we did this, and what we got was that these customers generally gave it a one or a two. They were very dissatisfied. And the reason why they were dissatisfied was all of these people think their issues are unique. And so they want customized solutions. And so to respond to that, the company is really designed as a research and development organization, and they're always producing customized things. And then what happens is then the customers get angry with them because they can't get the parts when they need them. Well, the company's just trying to do what the customer wanted. You know, one of the myths is the customer's always right. You know, sometimes the customers are wrong. And so the company went back and says, look, you seem angry with us because you ask for customized solutions. We give them to you, but the trade-off is you want the parts immediately. If you want us to store parts for you so that you can get them back, we have to go to more customized products for you. Are you okay with that? And when it was presented like that, the customer said, sure, we just want it to work. So they've changed their culture from an R&D culture to a production and operations culture. They actually moved their headquarters from Cambridge Technology Square to Quincy to symbolize the cultural change. So we worked with them on cultural change for a year, and then we redid the survey a year later, and now they're in the sevens and eights, whereas they were in the ones and twos. So again, this is a way you can, it's a simple, easy to way. You saw how long it took you to do this. It's a way to measure customer satisfaction. In the way I propose to you, if you have a lot of customers, like a bank, you could waste a lot of time trying to measure every customer. Not all customers are equally important. We say they're all important. No, they're not. There are some customers that are more important than other customers. For many of my clients, the 80-20 rule seems to apply. That 20% of your customers will provide 80% of your revenue. Certainly 20% of your customers will provide 80% of your problems, right? But then that's not necessarily the same customers, is it? I remember I was working for a large hotel chain, and I was talking to the CEO, and every time a customer stayed at this hotel chain, there was a guest satisfaction card, and they said, please fill this out. We're very interested in what you have to say. And people would fill this out. Well, the CEO doesn't really care what you have to say. He cares only those people that stay X number of days a year and spend X number of dollars. If you got your hotel room through Priceline and you paid $50, he doesn't care what you say. So he is only interested in the top 20%. So for some of you, you may just want to focus on your top customers. Any questions about that? finally, let's talk about grumpy candidates. And I'm going to ask you to read this and think about what you would do in response to this. It's a case. Now, let me give you the context, and let me set this up for you. This is a high technology company. It's really hard to find engineers who can do what this company needs to have done. So demand is really high. The company is based on the border of Rhode Island, and many of the employees actually live in Rhode Island, not Massachusetts. There's also another operation in California. There's another operation in Japan. You are a candidate to become the Vice President of Human Resources. And I'm the CEO. And I tell you, it's very important that we attract and we retain the engineers who can do this. They're very scarce, so we want to give them tender, loving care. So we want no problems. We want everybody happy. We just do what's necessary to keep these good people, because they can get other jobs, other places very easily. So that's the context. So read that. While you're reading that, let me give you a little background. How many of you do recruitment as part of your job? Okay. I tell you what I'm finding in my world, and you can then tell me what you're finding in yours. The literature shows that employment interviewing is probably one of the least effective tools to actually screen people. It's just very poor. And over the last few years, it's even gotten poorer. One is, job interviews are sort of like playing tennis. The more you do, the better you get. And people are getting really good at job interviews because the instability in the marketplace, you know, somebody might have had a career in one company for 20 years. Now they're more likely to have had a career in a company for 2 years. And so they have more experience doing job interviews. And how many of you have ever hired people whose highest and best professional value seems to be they know how to do job interviews very well. They can't do the job, but they sure know how to do the interview. There's more and more of those. And of course, there's outplacement firms that coach people on how to do job interviews. So you get people who are really good at doing job interviews. Second is reference checks. I'm finding reference checks increasingly useless and irrelevant. They're useless and irrelevant. One is because in certain companies, they're advised by general counsels, don't say anything except name, rank, and serial number. So you can't get any information at all. In other cases, people just lie. You know, they're friends, and they want their friends to get the job, and they'll just say whatever they think you want to hear so that you will make a hiring decision. And I've had several instances where people have told me straight out certain things that just turned out to be complete lies about the individual. How many of you have that experience? We certainly have two recent instances that show how lack of value references are. There's that horrible woman who killed her brother, and then she had this thing in the court because she slapped a woman in a restaurant, and then the University of Alabama hired her as a faculty person, and we know what happened after that. Then there was an even worse, there was Major Hassan was at Walter Reed as a psychiatrist. People had lots of questions. It was recorded that people had questions, and then when he was transferred to another fort in Texas, nobody ever said anything. And then remember that he killed several people? You know, that kind of stuff goes on all the time. References are just very tough. So what you've got is a recruitment piece that's built on a foundation that doesn't work. Job interviews don't work. We just do them because we somehow think we need to do them. But they don't work. References don't work. So when we're selecting people, we need to supplement this with something else that does work. And we use the arduous technique, and I'm going to describe the arduous technique. What we're trying to do is either we're going to select in grumpy people or select out grumpy people. Again, as I said, a lot of times you need grumpy people in an organization. There should be a healthy conflict between the asset side and the liability side. So that's good, but you should be deliberative about it. Now, don't select a grumpy person for a non-grumpy job. This is an example where the CEO wants a very positive-oriented person as head of HR. And the answer to the case is very simple. The CEO says, I want a C-level answer is to say to this employee, thank you very much, and do it. A B-level answer is, thank you very much, and do it, and then call the eyeglass company in Rhode Island and get the same benefits for our employees who live in Rhode Island, since most of our employees live in Rhode Island. Now, an A-level answer is, you not only do that, but you call California and Japan and arrange the same benefit for all employees worldwide. That's all he's looking for. And again, in the context of the strategy, in the context of what I laid out for you, it's pretty simple. Now, let me give you the theory. How many of you have computers on your desks? Okay. So you have the modern computers that when you make a change in, how many of you use Windows? Okay. So you make a change in a word check in Windows Word. But when you do that, it also makes changes in Outlook, makes changes in Excel, makes changes in PowerPoint. So in other words, the the Office software that has Word, Excel, PowerPoint, they all talk with each other, right? How many of you remember the old 286 and 386 machines during the MS-DOS days? They didn't talk with each other. Remember? So in other words, if you were in Word, now you want to do something in Excel, you had to get out of Word, then you had to go into Excel. Remember those days? Okay. Now, here's what Chris Argyris at Harvard University says. Suppose the brain is actually like one of those old 286, 386 machines with MS-DOS. And you got a piece of software in your head that says, this is my program of how I philosophically believe I am as a leader. I'm firm but fair. I have an open door policy. I treat everybody with respect. And if you gave me a lie detector test, I would pass it. Because I really believe that about myself. Then there's another program on this part of the brain that says, this is the program that tells me how I actually behave. And suppose they're different programs. And suppose like the 286, 386 machines, not only do they not talk with each other, but in order to access one, you have to disable the other. In other words, under the old 286, 386 machines, you can't do Word and Excel. You can do one or the other, but when you do one, you disable the other. So that's what he's saying. We've all observed people who say one thing and they do something else, and we call them hypocrites. Arturus would say, no, they're not being hypocrites. They actually don't know. They actually think this way about themselves. They would pass a lie detector test because they really believe it. Then when they actually do something differently, the two programs are not talking with each other. Totally separate. So here's a very simple case that we do when we're recruiting. We set up a situation where there could be multiple choices. It's not clear, like this case. It's a dilemma. We tee it off, we make it clear. And then we say, okay, now, what would you do? Now, usually what happens in a job interview situation, the person usually says, because I teed them up the same way I teed you up, well, of course, I'm going to say yes to the employee. I'm going to thank them very much. I'm going to be very courteous to the employee. I said, that's great. That's wonderful. So, I have a tape recorder here. So I'm going to put the tape recorder here, and then I'm going to turn it on, and I'm going to be the employee. Okay? Click. So, what do you think about my idea? Wouldn't you know it? The candidates then start getting into this HR legalese thing. Well, thank you very much, but we have to check with our lawyers to see if this is really a good opportunity. If we have to do our due diligence to make sure this is the best opportunity. Holy Christ. What they say, once they say, I've turned the tape recorder on, and what they said they would say, totally different things. And they don't know that they just shot themselves in the foot. And there was absolutely nothing hidden. They knew they had to say something positive. They knew they had to be nice to the employees. They couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. Again, that's predictive of what Argyris would say. So again, we use cases like these to supplement the job interview, because the job interview is such a poor predictor of behavior. And the Argyris cases work so well. Again, I mentioned this in the context that there are times you want to hire grumpy people, times you don't want to hire grumpy people. It's the context, it's the job. And be deliberate, know who you're hiring, select well, and don't rely on the things that don't work. And what doesn't work are job interviews and reference checks. So do something different. If anybody would like a copy of what I just said and some more cases, just give me your business cards and put case on that, and I'll be glad to send that to you. Let me summarize what I've been saying and then be open to questions and comments. If any of you want a copy of I have some slides prepared about the Reichelt most important questions. Just type in, write in the word Reichelt and give it to me, and I'll give you those slides. If any of you would like a copy of a draft of my MIT Sloan Management Review piece on looking at the basic accounting equation as a framework for organization structure, just put MIT on there. I'd be glad to send it to you. Grumpiness is like cinnamon for me. I love cappuccino, and I love to put cinnamon in my cappuccino. And a little bit of cinnamon is great. And if I put a lot of cinnamon in, it's not great. And so, to me, grumpiness is like cinnamon. In the little doses, it's great. As leaders, you need to be deliberate about the kind of grumpies that you want in your organization. It has to be tied to some sort of strategy. And one of the points that I'm trying to make is a well-run organization should have strong representation on the asset enhancement side of things and on the liability reduction side of things. So, for example, my company, my wife is my partner. I tend to be on the asset enhancement side of things. I'm in the sales and marketing area. My wife, on the other hand, tends to be cautious, conservative, and she's perfect on the liabilities side. So we often disagree, and that's good. You want strong people on both sides. Conflict is good. Don't get rid of this "we're one big happy family" stuff. It's not about being a family, it's about business. Second thing is watch your words. And for those of you who are managers, control the words. We go as far as to recommend scripts and then have reward and punishment systems for people who follow the scripts and punishment systems for people that don't. Why is that important? Because how do you change behavior? You can change it by changing people's hearts first and then behavior changes, or you change what people verbalize and then their hearts will follow what they verbalize over and over and over again. We know from neuroanatomy studies that when you do something over and over and over again, and when you say something over and over and over again, the brain develops neural pathways, and then it becomes a habit. And once it becomes a habit, it's very hard to break. So you're in the management of word business. In the end, that's not about comfort. It's about what is required to survive and thrive over the next 5 years as the economy moves to what I think is going to be an experience-based culture. You know, I'd like to close with a comment I once heard the founder of Southwest Airlines make. He said, you know, in the end, it's not about planes, because we have good planes and so do our competitors. It's not about safety, because we're highly regulated. There's certain things we have to do or we're going to be out of business. Same thing about our competitors. It's not about price, because we have limited ability to change prices. In the end, it's about customer experience. We're moving much more towards an experience-based culture. That's the secret that Disney understands. That's the secret Southwest Airlines understands. That's why people will go to Neiman Marcus. They could get the goods cheaper somewhere else. They know it. They can't get the experience anywhere else. Any questions? Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.